Greetings, crew of the Gaian Navigation Experiment, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, as some people like to call me. And it is the 3rd of March, 2012. Title of this briefing is The Ultimate Threat to the Divine Experiment. And if that doesn't get your attention, I don't know what will. Those of you who've been following the Gaian Navigation Experiment since summer of 2011, going on around 9 months now, will of course recognize that this is the cliffhanger. This is the great question that looms before us. And the practice of the Gaian Navigation Experiment, among other things, brings us into a cohesion of attention. It allows each individual in the practice to combine their power of attention with the attention of the entire group. It could be called a kind of group contemplation, as it were, but not a group meditation, because it's not of the nature of meditation. This practice is not of the nature of meditation, and it's not passive. It's not a calling in of something into your consciousness, but rather it is a focus and amplification of your powers of attention. So for some time now, we've been directing our powers of attention to the constellation of Cetus. This constellation consists of a long, sprawling torso that lies below the ecliptic constellation of the Fishes. And attached to this torso, but very distinctly separate from it in the pattern of the star formation, is the head of Cetus. Very interesting that you see the head of Cetus as this pentagonal, this sort of a distorted pentagonal form that sits beneath the ecliptic constellation of the Ram. And the greater part of the constellation of Cetus, the torso and the limbs, sprawls beneath the constellation of the Fishes. Such is the image we have been contemplating. You can observe that image in the night sky if you're lucky. Well, you can't right now because the sun is moving into that area, but we have been able to do so through the summer and fall and winter of last year. Or you can look at a drawing of the constellation of Cetus and contemplate various images of Cetus that you might find in astronomy books and in books of ancient star lore. Now, in the imaginative setup of this practice, the visionary practice of planetary tantra, I have suggested that the body of Cetus, in some respect, represents a kind of living dead entity, a kind of a zombie force that nevertheless expels or exudes, I should say, pestilent and lethal vapors, as you might find toxic and noxious vapors emitted by a rotting corpse. So we have the rotting corpse of Cetus floating belly up, as it were, on the cosmic slipstream where the mothership is making her journey. She must make a passage. She must make a transit, a trajectory past this horrific and somewhat dangerous obstacle in the waters. And then, of course, she passes the pentagonal figure of the head of Cetus, which is currently what is happening in an imaginative sense. As that happens, we, the human species, who are participants to the voyage of the planetary mothership, realize in our minds and imaginations, as well as emotionally and intellectually, the significance of this mythic figure the monster of Cetus with its massive torso and its pentagonal face, which I call the satanic mask of Cetus. Within the carefully timed framework of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, we've been looking forward with great anticipation to the moment that now arises. This is the moment when we perceive what is the ultimate threat to the divine experiment on Earth, the divine experiment with humanity currently unfolding on this planet. And we do not merely perceive it for ourselves or even in ourselves, but we perceive it through and in the awakening of the divine Sophia herself. We perceive it as she does. Now, this current navigator briefing, number 3, falls between crewnotes 16 and crewnotes 17. And if you look on gaiaspora.org, on the page which lists the GNE audio files, you'll see that there are 2 talks on the initial conditions of the divine experiment, part 1 and part 2. And those talks are linked to crew notes number 16. So we are midway between crew notes number 16 and 17. And in 17, I will specify exactly what were the initial conditions that the Aeon Sophia prefigured in her unilateral dreaming that make our situation on this planet what it actually is. This scenario provides an opportunity of an absolutely unique kind, something that has never been articulated before in this particular way, or in any way, to be quite frank with you. We have the opportunity now, in March and April of 2012, to see the initial terms of this divine experiment and thereby to understand how and why it has gone so badly wrong, as well as to understand how to correct it. Without understanding the initial conditions as she herself understood them, cannot possibly see our role in correction at this time. Now, let me reiterate just for a moment my role as the navigator of the Gaia Navigation Experiment. It is, of course, one and the same with my role as a practitioner of telestic shamanism. That is a practice accessible now to everyone hearing my words. And so whatever I'm doing, you can also do. And in some respects, some of you are already doing it, operating out of your deep intuitive skills. All you need is some particular methodology of gnosis and some particular techniques of telestic shamanism, which I can provide by example. That's all you need in order to become adept yourself in this practice, this visionary practice. So, I want to remind you that in this practice, we always observe the story and stay in the framework of the story. It's not John Lash that guides. It's not some ancient fragments of sacred knowledge retrieved from parchments. It's not some lines written in a very late and garbled and inadequate rendition of Gnostic documents. It's not any of that guides us and directs us. What guides us and directs us is her story. So, consistent with that principle, I ought to talk about the ultimate threat to the divine experiment strictly in narrative terms. I ought to present it in a story form, similar to the way in which I presented the surreal episode of the giant mantis. In crew notes 17 and the audio files linked to those notes, that is exactly what I intend to do. I intend to go back to episode 4 of the standard version of the Fallen Goddess scenario, FGS 1.0, and continue to read from pages belonging to episode 4. I am not going to jump ahead to episode 5 as I indicated that I would do. That was an error. We remain in episode 4 until the moment that Sophia plunges from the galactic core. So there are still events and incidents that occurred at that moment in the two talks of February 23rd, the initial conditions of the divine experiment 1 and 2, I merely set up the background for us to understand how Sophia designed our experiment. Just the background, just the conditions that she herself was facing. For instance, the fact that she had observed, along with the elder eons, who were the veteran scientists and engineers and artists of the Pleroma, that she had observed with them 9 previous experiments with the anthropic strain, which ended catastrophically. But that is only the background of her own design, unilateral design, of the current experiment. So all of that has to be presented in a narrative form, in a storytelling form, to be consistent with this practice and to remain within the story, even as we carefully and rigorously amplify the story. You know, right now, March 2012, I am the main individual to amplify the story. But it won't always be that way. It need not always be that way, and it certainly should not always be that way. I happen to be the main authorial voice of the moment, if you want to put it in those terms. But to assume the authorial power that I demonstrate is within the capacity of each one of you. And the amplification of the story, the addition of details, the embellishment of details, and the wider extrapolation of the entire plot of the 9 episodes is within the range of human imagination. You're given this endowment of imagination and the storytelling and communicating powers of our species in order to be able to do this yourself. And I assure you that if it is your highest desire to do so, you can do that voraciously, accurately, truthfully, as long as you remain within the framework of the story. Having made that case for the practice of the narrative method, I want to say that in this navigator briefing, I am departing slightly from that method. I'm not going to tell in a narrative form the remaining part of episode 4. I'm not going to relate or recount it now in a narrative form. That's coming soon, in a matter of a day or so. My intention now is actually to set you up for that coming narrative presentation. My intention is to look at the issue, the sensational and paramount issue of the ultimate threat, from a couple of different viewpoints. It is helpful, I believe, it would be helpful to have somewhat of a conceptual framework of orientation to this narrative factor. This is a huge, huge factor in the plot of the Sophianic story, obviously, and it bears in the most crucial and dramatic way upon the human situation today. It bears on the very question of our survival as a species. If we are not able to recognize and face and overcome this ultimate threat, the divine experiment will crash and fail in this kalpa. Not permanently. It will not be the end of Anthropos 10. It will not be the end of our strain, but it will be the end of the experiment in this kalpa, that is to say, the 26,000-year period of time that ends in 2216 CE, in 2216, or about 204 years from now into the future. Granted, 204 years into the future may seem like a long shot, and you may even wonder, considering the deplorable and degenerate, insane, deranged, and disgusting condition of a great many of the members of the human race today, that it would be in itself a miracle if we could crawl and drag our sorry asses to the end of the kalpa. But bear in mind that at the same time that we are trapped in linear time frame, the linear time frame particular to our biological and neurochemical framework, what is 204 years to us is about 11 to 12 minutes in her time. She achieves correction itself. She sets the initial conditions of correction in 10 seconds. And then she proceeds to launch into the course of correction that she has established for 11 or 12 minutes to bring her and the entire world with her and all living species with her and all the inorganic and organic components of the earth and the atmospheric components of the earth with her, and with her to the end of the kalpa. Try to wrap your mind around this time formula that I present. It's an extremely helpful tool in telestic practice. So, with all that said, I'm going to launch directly into the issue of the ultimate threat to the divine experiment with Anthropos 10, that's us, the 10th strain, to undergo a number of cycles or kalpas of experimental development in a planetary matrix. We are, of course, unique and entirely different from the preceding 9 strains of the Anthropos, in that the setting or petri dish or laboratory for the experiment in which we are engaged is the body and imminent divine presence of Sophia herself. That is not the case with any of the preceding 9 experiments. She is not only the source of the human genome and the source of our experiment on this planet, but she is the setting of the experiment itself. Remember, the 3 S's of telestic education: source, setting, and story. She is the source, she is the setting of the experiment, and her biography is the story that teaches us how the experiment is set up, how it went wrong, and how it can be corrected. It's just as simple as that. As I said, I'm not going to proceed in this Navigator Briefing 3 with a narrative presentation. Rather, it would be best if you listen to this talk before you listen to the narrative counterpart. It would be best to prepare yourself with a few concepts. The human mind operates by conceptual perspectives. These concepts are helpful in handling the impact, the enormous impact that comes with the part of her narrative that I am currently due to reveal, namely the remainder of the missing elements in episode 4, immediately prior to her plunge from the Pleroma, from the galactic core. So in what I'm doing now, I propose to you three conceptual perspectives to approach the momentous question, what is the ultimate threat to the divine experiment that Sophia designed for humanity on this planet? Three perspectives, three concepts, three approaches to this momentous question. One, here I find it appropriate to cite something that, to cite a source of, what shall I say, a source of discussion, a source of information, if you want to use that word, that is prevalent on the internet and YouTube regarding the current insanity of the human race and what we're facing in the global picture, what we're facing regarding to regarding the global predators and so forth. Of course, there are a great number of people on the in the alternative media who are calling the game of the globalist predators. Some of them are very, very good at it, and some of them are giving the rest of us the benefit of their research and the cogency of their forensic investigations of the psychotic and psychopathic orchestrations of the predators, and this is a fantastic education. We all need to undergo this education. That is, in my mind, the most valuable opportunity offered by the alternative media. I'm referring here specifically to the popular and rather demagogic talk show host Alex Jones. And I have to hand it to Alex Jones, regardless of what else he may be doing and regardless of what his agenda may be, I have to hand it to Alex Jones that he has nailed the ultimate threat. And he has done something absolutely remarkable. He has put a name on it. And I am certain that the name that Alex Jones has put on it, which is not his invention, I'll tell you in a moment where it comes from, is going to go out into the collective discourse on this planet, and is going to explode like a massive signal in the collective psyche of humanity. I can guarantee that. Recently, just a couple of days ago, a day or two ago, maybe March 1st, Jones released on the internet through Prison Planet TV, and by the way, the Prison Planet concept, as I've said before, comes from the Gnostics. They said that the Archons create a virtual reality matrix around us that makes it appear as if the planet, which is actually a paradise provided for our enjoyment and education, makes it appear that the planet is a prison. On PrisonPlanet.tv and on his YouTube channel, Alex Jones posted a half an hour film called New World Order, Blueprint of Madmen. And it's very well worth watching this 35-minute presentation. It's extremely frightening. And if it doesn't frighten you, you're not paying attention. It is based, as far as I can tell, entirely on fact. Nothing is made up. Nothing is fabricated. Nothing is spun. This is cold, hard fact. The figures are true. And this documentary, which opens with a funny little satirical episode acted out by Alex Jones himself, is certainly a valuable contribution to our understanding of the psychotic breakdown of humanity that is currently taking place. So I said, it's a big claim, but I stand behind it, that Alex Jones can be acknowledged for having put a name on the ultimate threat to the divine experiment, and that name is Democide. D-E-M-O-C-I-D-E. Now, the word Democide does not come from Jones. In fact, if you look it up, you'll find that it was defined by a certain political scientist named R.J. Rummel. And he was professor of sociology and political sciences in Hawaii, actually. And he lived, he was born in 1932. I suppose he may still be alive today. And yes, he was professor emeritus of political science at the University of Hawaii. Wrote many books. He put into academic discourse the word democide, which may be defined as follows. Democide is the murder of any person or people by a government, including genocide, politicide, and mass murder, end quote. So, democide is a really interesting term. Compare it, for instance, to genocide. It's not the same. Term genocide, you cannot say that genocide is the ultimate threat to the human experience. Why not? It's not good enough a term. Term genocide refers to the targets of murderous assault, people. Genocide means the mass murder of people. It is a term that describes who is murdered, but it does not tell you by whom those people are murdered. And so the term democide is more pertinent, much, much more pertinent, because according to the definition of its originator, Professor Rummel, it indicates the murder of any person or people by a government. By a government. Therefore, democide is different from genocide in that the former term actually defines the agent of genocide, whereas genocide only defines the target. So it has to be said that Alex Jones, whatever else one may think of him, has really hit the nail on the head. And he has named the ultimate threat to the human experiment, the ultimate threat to humanity today, to the 6.5 billion people on this planet, is government that is intent in its programs and its agenda to annihilate, murder, and eliminate the vast majority of the populations over which it reigns. Government, the authorities. The murder of a person or people by the authorities, which are held in the role of authority by those very people who are murdered. So we are very, very close to the Gnostic warning about the authorities, that is to say the archons. They are the authorities or rulers. That is two alternative translations that are often used for the Greek word archon. in the time of the Nag Hammadi text, and before that in the time of the alleged historical Jesus, or in the time of Socrates even. Socrates was condemned by when Athens was under the domination of the 30 archons, the 30 tyrants. And archon simply means governor. Today, who are the archons in the world? Well, in the United States, they are the feds. The feds are the archons. And these authorities, who are raised to the role of authority by the common mass of people, if you will, have an agenda to murder and eliminate most of the common mass of people. This is the ultimate threat. Why they have that agenda, which is often called the eugenics agenda, why they have that agenda is a deeper question. But for right now, taking the first point of approach here, let's take it on board that the term democide is extremely pertinent and valuable. Democide identifies the sociological and historical face of the ultimate threat, also the existential face, the imminent face, because it is an imminent danger. The democidal program of the authorities of this world, including those of the federal government of the United States, the governments of other countries, and also, most significantly, including the bureaucratic instrument of the United Nations, these institutions all share one common motive, one common drive, and that is democide. Again, I want to emphasize that if we would ask ourselves, well, why on earth would the governments constructed by people in order to direct and manage society turn against the members of society in this murderous fashion? Why? That is a deep question. And the answer to that question is very, very close. And I don't mean the abstract answer. I don't mean an intellectual answer. I don't mean something clever. I don't mean another thing to think about. When you get the answer to that, either your conscience is engaged or you're a goner. So we are really, really close to the edge of survival with this concept of democide. Second approach, I would have you consider this. When the Turton presents the full narrative form of the remaining parts of episode 4 of the Sophianic Vision story, becomes possible to see exactly how the Aeon Sophia designed our experiment based on what she learned from the previous 9 experiments that failed. Becomes possible to put ourselves into her mind and see through her eyes and her perspective what is the ultimate threat faced by any strain of the Anthropos when it emerges in a planetary experiment. Obviously, she formulated her own understanding of that threat based on what she saw in the previous 9 experiments. So let me remind you that the main thing that she saw, and all the other attending aeons observed this as well, observed it with some amazement and bafflement, was that the germinal plasm of the Anthropos, like a virus or bacteria, when introduced into a planetary laboratory, eventually turned against the laboratory. It turned against its own culture, its own environment. The Ansophia contemplated deeply how this could ever have happened. What was it about the calibration of the capacities of her pet species, the Anthropos, that caused it to behave in this self-annihilating manner? Now I ask you to focus your minds very closely on this question. And I ask you to consider that for Sophia herself, the ultimate threat is not exactly as we see it from within the experiment. I know this is not an easy thing to ask, but the distinction is absolutely crucial. As the narrative rendition of these events will show, Sophia had a broad understanding of what was wrong with the experiment. She arrived at certain sound conclusions regarding what had gone wrong, and she saw it broadly. She saw that there were several factors causing the divine experiment to go wrong in those first 9 instances. And she saw that that tendency was due to the way that the Anthropos was calibrated. That's the syntax referring to the 7 components making up the endowment of the Anthropos, as I've covered in previous talks. Just to review for you, those 7 components, each of which has precise chemical, neurochemical, and physiological correlates or reciprocates, run down like this. 1, nous, that is to say, intelligence, the germ plasm of nucleic acid. 2, dianoia, capacity to communicate and build symbolic systems and codes. 3, metanoia, the capacity for framing perspectives and paradigms and then melting them down and moving on to others. 5, perinoia, which is my proposed neologism, which is the ludic capacity, the ability to pretend and play, connected intimately with the endorphins of the human body. 5, the enthymesis, or the enthusiasm of the divine eros, which actually operates through your hemoglobin in the blood system. 6 and 7, the 2 signature components of thelete, which is connotative latitude coming from the aeon thelete, and wisdom or sophia, cognitive apprehension or proprioception, to use that awkward but extremely accurate and important term, and that is derived from the aeon sophia herself, to which can be added 8, the luminous epinoia, which was actually added after the endowment had been calibrated and the Anthropos phenome had been projected into the galactic limbs for propagation through the streaming of plasmatic currents in the armature of the galactic arms. So, considering all those elements, those are the components of the human endowment, the cognitive and conative components. Considering all those elements, the Aeon Sophia scrutinized very carefully what it was in the calibration of those traits and those capacities of human potential that had caused the aberrations that led to the catastrophic failure of these 9 previous experiments. And of course, she had various reflections on that, which we ourselves are now able to review due to the timing of her own recall. Absolutely decisive moment in this recall was February 27th, when the apogee of the moon reached 12 degrees of the sign Taurus, which is directly in front of the satanic mask of Cetus, with Jupiter nearby, about 5 degrees away. And so between that apogee surge of February 27th and the upcoming apogee surge, which would be on March 26th, we ourselves are transpiring in real time with the recall of the Wisdom Goddess. And this month of March 2012, the first anniversary since the onset of correction, is the single moment to participate in her recall and to realize what she sees, what she saw, and what she sees today. Now, right here at this point, in this briefing, I'm going to say something that ought to be said more rigorously and consistently in a narrative form. But instead, I'm stating it in an expository form for the moment. Reason being, as I suggested earlier, is that the scope and the impact of this current, of these currently revealed features of her story are so enormous that the human mind needs a certain conceptual framework to brace itself to receive these elements, to receive the narrative elements. We need a certain conceptual framework, and so I'm presenting now in exposition, as it were, what comes to be presented in the narration of the concluding moments of episode 4. After she had summed up the 3 or 4 various factors that she deemed instrumental in bringing about the catastrophic ending of these experiments, after she summed it all up, she sort of stepped back and came to an overview. And the thinking that occurred in her mind, in the mind of the divine Aeon at that moment, was something like this. Well, yes, I can see how the way that the Anthropos has been designed, due to the very rich and intensely promising nature of its gifts, due to the intensely promising nature of its gifts, due to its excess of talents, as it were, I can see how one or the other thing out of 3 or 4 factors could cause the experiment to go wrong. But that is not the ultimate threat, as she saw it. Because what she concluded was that even if these various factors drove the experiment in the wrong direction, the Anthropos could correct itself and avoid a catastrophic ending. So there you have it. There is the operative syntax. It could correct itself. It's absolutely paramount to bear in mind that the design of our human endowment contains this unique capacity for self-correction. I've discussed this many times, and I've emphasized in the elaboration and interpretation of numerous Gnostic texts from Nag Hammadi the importance of self-correction. Gnostics themselves, the Telestai, were certainly keen on this, and it was the central plank of their educational platform. Where do you find the capacity for self-correction? Well, quite simply, you find it in a combination of two of those listed factors of our endowment. Specifically, the element of dianoia and the element of metanoia. Now, it can be said, of course, that nous itself, the primary divine intelligence, contains the capacity for self-correction, and that is certainly so. But to have a more specific view of our capacity for self-correction, which is a prodigious endowment of our species exceeding any other living creature on earth, you want to look at the cooperation of dianoia and metanoia. The combination of those two working together brings this capacity of self-correction to an extraordinary optimal level that is not evident in the behavior of other animals. All sentient creatures on earth, from beavers to bears to monarch butterflies to whales to elephants, have the endowment of nous as we do. They also have a germ of divine intelligence, and due to the innate self-correcting capacity of nous, they likewise can learn by trial and error. But what brings this learning by trial and error to an extraordinary, excessive, and extravagant level of display in our species alone? What is that? It is the combination of dianoia and metanoia. Why? Simply because dianoia, which relates to our ability to communicate, also relates to our ability to compare things. Consider why we communicate and why we have conversations with each other. We go to a film. I tell you my views of the film. You tell me yours. We compare our views. This is dianoia. By comparing our views, we each arrive at not only a more sophisticated understanding of our own views, but we may even arrive at a third viewpoint, which is a compound of our two views, which surpasses and exceeds the acuity and veracity of a single view. This is the fantastic gift of dianoia. And when we combine that with metanoia, which is our ability to frame situations in a conceptual way so that we can stand outside them and analyze them so as to better handle them when we re-enter those situations, you can imagine what you get by the combination of our dianoic and metanoic capacities. You get an extravagant ability for self-correction. The divine Sophia, who designed us, absolutely knows this and sees this as clear as day. And as she was considering what went wrong with these experiments, she thought, well, yeah, I can see that these certain tendencies, and this is what is to be revealed in the coming narrative, oh yeah, the deviation from the environment, the problem with learning what needs to be learned from the habitat in which this sentient entity emerges and so forth. All of these things, yes, yes, yes. But even as dangerous and risky as any of these tendencies might be, we have such an enormous capacity to self-correct that we could compensate and there would ultimately be no danger. So how could it go wrong? Well, in her mind, she saw, and remember, the operative phrase here, this is in her mind. This is what the ultimate threat to the divine experiment appears to be, and actually is, from the perspective of Sophia herself. Amnesia. It's amnesia. Even though we have the capacity to correct what we did wrong, if we forget our experience, we won't know what needs to be corrected. Now let me give you a flagrant and inescapable example of this proposition. There are many megalithic structures around the world composed of huge blocks of stone, sometimes weighing over 100 tons, such as at Baalbek in Lebanon, in the mountains of Peru and South America, and of course the Egyptian pyramids. And as we contemplate these megalithic stone structures today, we're stunned. We stand before them absolutely stunned. Why? Because these structures, more than anything else in the physical evidence of human experiment, of human experience, mirror to us our state of amnesia. We are in a state of amnesia standing in front of the Great Pyramids. It's as if you came down one morning into your living room and there was an elaborate Tinker Toy set erected and filling the whole middle of the living room so that you have to walk around it. You just can't ignore it. It's just massive. It's elaborate. And as a matter of fact, you yourself erected that Tinker Toy set the night before. But when you come down the next morning and you see it, you can't remember that you even did it or how you did it. Certainly, if you can't remember that you did it, you're certainly not going to remember how you did it. This is what Sophia saw as the ultimate threat to our experience. Diachronic amnesia. That is the inability to recall what the human species collectively has done and achieved over long periods of time. I say diachronic amnesia to distinguish it from episodic amnesia. An episodic amnesia of the human species would be mean that, for instance, we could not remember what happened in the pre-Incan period of civilization in South America. Okay? There's an episode that we could not remember. I'm not talking here about not remembering an episode. I'm talking about diachronic amnesia. That is to say, the failure of memory over a whole sequence of successive events in linear time. Consequent to this diachronic amnesia, we have huge lapses in memory. One of the few people who has addressed this problem was Immanuel Velikovsky. As a matter of fact, at the end of his career as a writer and investigator, he concentrated deeply on this subject. So he wrote Mankind in Amnesia. And according to Velikovsky's view, which is very, very much worth reviewing, the amnesia of mankind, the collective amnesia which prevents us from remembering what happened to us in previous epochs of human civilization, is due to trauma. And there's, of course, another theme here that is extremely relevant to these considerations. We know that someone in an accident, for instance, in a car accident, will not be able to remember what happened during the moment that the accident actually took place. So there is an undeniable connection between traumatic experience and amnesia. And the Aeon Sophia herself saw this, and she realized with some shock and with enormous concern for her pet species that even though we are extremely gifted with self-correction, if we can't remember what we did, then we won't be able to remember what we did wrong. Now, today, when you look at the pyramids, I would tell you this. What is the riddle of the Great Pyramids? Well, they were a kind of power plant. Pyramids were power plants. They were used in certain respect for symbolic and ritual activities performed by the Osirian cults and so forth. But that was all kind of a big game of theater. In fact, the whole Egyptian dynastic scene was largely a big game of theater, social theater, theocratic theater, theocratic spectacle, to mind control the people of the time and to convince them that the Egyptian pharaohs and the dynastic lines of the pharaohs represented living gods or divine superhuman beings embodied in human form. But much better explanation is that the pyramids were essentially energy-generating devices, that Egypt ran on electricity somewhat in the same way as Tesla wished, perhaps through another kind of dynamics involving plasma and the manipulation of plasma fields and piezoelectric fields. But they ran sort of like Tesla machines, generating electricity and energy. And they were great factories and great instruments of power. The pyramids were power plants. Just take on board that hypothesis for a moment. Were that to be the case, we have to admit that we don't know how we constructed those power plants, and we don't know what went wrong that caused those power plants to be shut down or either to fail or both. Because obviously today, the Egyptian pyramids, not just the ones on Giza, but those all over the land of Egypt, don't operate as power plants. They don't generate power. Well, what happened? How did we set them up in the first place? What happened to them? What caused them to be abandoned? What caused these giant, gargantuan mechanisms of energy generation to fail? We don't know, because we suffer from diachronic amnesia. And diachronic amnesia, in the view of the Aeon Sophia herself, is the ultimate threat to the human experiment on this planet. So finally, we come to conceptual perspective number 3. And this is really, really a big, big whammy. This is a big whammy right between the eyes. I'm only going to indicate briefly what this is. I'm going to give the introduction, the cue, to set up the narrative rendition of these same matters. When Sophia looked at the human endowment and the way that she and Thelite had calibrated these capacities, these 7 capacities, she realized that the problem of our endowment, the drawback of our own gifts, as it were, the blowback of our own genius, as we ourselves would face it, was slightly different from what she saw. Certainly, diachronic amnesia is a vast, vast problem. And we need to really consider that. There is a solution for diachronic amnesia in the correction process. And that is coming up relatively soon. And I can indicate the timing and the parameters of that quite clearly and specifically. My pleasure to do so. But for now, just let me say that in her review of those 9 catastrophic experiments, which determined how she set up the current experiment, the Aeon Sophia felt enormous concern about a syndrome that would arise with the kind of genius that is particular to our species. You can call this syndrome backlash or a counterproductive risk of our specific genius. It cannot be described by the identification or indication of one single element in the endowment. The divine Sophia saw that when two elements combine in a certain manner, it produces an extremely dangerous syndrome leading to delusion, self-delusion, and self-destruction. And that this syndrome spreads through the human race in the manner of an infection that goes from one cell to another. So it spreads from one individual to another. And every single individual who becomes infected with this syndrome is prone to the deviation that leads into self-delusion and self-deceit, and from there into annihilation. What exactly is this fatal combination of capacities? Well, remember that factor number 4 in our endowment is called paranoia, and it refers to the ludic capacity, our ability to play and pretend. When that capacity is combined with one other element, it produces the most dangerous aberration that could possibly arise for our species. The other element comes actually from the male component of the design of the Anthropos phenome. Remember that the consort of Sophia was Thelete, and remember the component that Thelete added to the experiment, to our design, which is to say, conative latitude. Remember also that I pointed out the bizarre fact that free will, conative latitude, the ability to push the envelope, the ability to take enormous risks with our will, is physiologically connected with adrenochrome or adrenocortisone, as it's more properly called. And this adrenocortisone is the chemical of fear. And so, the natural fear, and I emphasize that it is natural, the natural fear that we're provided to help us deal with free will and not go too far, when it combines with paranoia, produces a disastrous tendency. And this tendency is precisely what has led humanity today to its current insanity, to its immersion in deceit, all the way to the brink of self-annihilation. In order to provide the exact syntax for grasping this momentous proposition, I suggest that you separate the word fear from the word phobia. Fear and its neurochemical component, adrenocortisone, is a good thing. We need fear in order to handle the signature endowment of Thelete. If I'm driving a car and I start to drive recklessly on the road, my fear tells me that I'm being reckless. Therefore, I correct my behavior and I drive more carefully. Fear is an absolutely essential and beneficial component in our endowment. But phobia is not. And phobia is what becomes of our natural fear when it is combined with the capacity of paranoia, of play and pretending. This combination of play and pretending with natural fear mutates natural fear into phobia. And then that phobia feeds back into paranoia. It feeds back into the natural capacities of play and pretending and distorts and deviates them and drives us into self-destructive insanity. This is the core and essence of the ultimate threat to the human experience as we ourselves are at the source of that threat. So, I offer these conceptual and guiding remarks as a prelude to the next narration of episode 4 of the Sophianic Vision story. And I wish to emphasize to you all who are hearing these words, whether you are hearing them in March of 2012 or at some later time in the future, some future time, that in this moment of March and April 2012, the Aeon Sophia herself is coming to terms with this threat. She's seeing beyond what she saw in her own perspective regarding diachronic amnesia. That is certainly a problem. She can provide the solution to that problem. But now, being with us in the earth, being the imminent presence of the earth, being empathic with us and co-active in every single aspect of our cognitive and cognitive functions, she is recognizing what we have on board that is driving us over the cliff just now. And so she herself, in a sense, is formulating and facing this threat, the ultimate threat to the divine experiment, in the same moment that we ourselves do in real time.